we have experienced these past 2 decades is not a million miles away from the horticultural revolution that has taken place in our herbaceous borders and sunken beds. Where once we were satisfied with our biennials, poorly coloured flowers thrusting weakly out of the earth and blooming a few times a year, if we were lucky, now we are demanding both variety and continuity in our flowers, the passionate colours of exotic blooms 365 days a year. Where once gardeners swore by the reliability of the self-pollinating plant, in which pollen is transferred from the stamen to the stigma of the same flower, autogamy, now we are more adventurous, positively singing the praises of cross-pollination, where pollen is transferred from one flower to another on the same plant, gaitonogamy, or to a flower of another plant of the same species, xenogamy. The birds and the bees, the thick haze of pollen, these are all to be encouraged. Yes, self-pollination is the simpler and more certain of the two fertilization processes, especially for many species that colonize by copiously repeating the same parental strain. But a species cloning such uniform offspring runs the risk of having its entire population wiped out by a single evolutionary event. In the garden, as in the social and political arena, change should be the only constant. Our parents and our parents' petunias have learnt this lesson the hard way. The march of history is unsentimental, tramping over a generation and its annuals with ruthless determination. The fact is, cross-pollination produces more varied offspring that are better able to cope with the changed environment. It is said cross-pollinating plants also tend to produce more and better quality seeds. If my 1-year-old son is anything to go by, a cross-pollination between a lapsed Catholic horticulturist feminist and an intellectual Jew, then I can certainly vouch for the truth of this. Sisters, the bottom line is this. If we are to continue wearing flowers in our hair into the next decade, they must be hardy and ever at hand, something only the truly mothering gardener can ensure. If we wish to provide happy playgrounds for our children and corners of contemplation for our husbands, we need to create gardens of diversity and interest. Mother Earth is great and plentiful, but even she requires the occasional helping hand. Joyce Chalfin, from The New Flower Power, published 1976, Caterpillar Press. Joyce Chalfin wrote The New Flower Power in a pokey attic room overlooking her own rambling garden during the blistering summer of 76. It was an ingenuous beginning for a strange little book, more about relationships than flowers, that went on to sell well and steadily through the late 70s. Not a coffee table essential by any means, but a close look at any baby boomer's bookshelves will reveal it lying dusty and neglected near those other familiars, Dr. Spock, Shirley Conran, a battered woman's press copy of The Third Life of Grange Copeland by Alice Walker. The popularity of The New Flower Power surprised no one more than Joyce. It had practically written itself, taking only 3 months, most of which she spent dressed in a tiny t-shirt and a pair of briefs in an attempt to beat the heat, breastfeeding Joshua intermittently, almost absent-mindedly, and thinking to herself between easy-flowing paragraphs that this was exactly the life she had hoped for. This was the future she dared to envisage when she first saw Marcus's intelligent little eyes giving her big white legs the once-over as she crossed the quad of his Oxbridge College, miniskirted 7 years earlier. She was one of those people who knew immediately, at first sight, even as her future spouse opened his mouth to say an initial nervous hello. A very happy marriage. That summer of 76, what with the heat and the flies and the endless melodies of ice cream vans, things happened in a haze. Sometimes Joyce had to pinch herself to make sure this was real. Marcus's office was down the hall on the right. Twice a day she'd pace down the corridor, Joshua on one substantial hip, nudging open the door with the other, just to check he was still there, that he really existed. And, leaning lustily over the desk, she'd grab a kiss from her favourite genius, hard at work on his peculiar helixes, his letters and numbers. She liked to pull him away from all that and show him the latest remarkable thing that Joshua had done or learnt. Sounds, letter recognition, coordinated movement, imitation, just like you, she'd say to Marcus, good genes, he'd say to her, patting her behind and luxurious thighs, weighing each breast in his hand, patting her small belly, generally admiring his English pear, his earth goddess. And then she'd be satisfied, padding back to her office like a big cat with a cub in its jaws, covered in a light layer of happy sweat. In an aimless, happy way, she could hear herself murmuring, an oral version of the toilet door doodles of adolescence, Joyce and Marcus, Marcus and Joyce. Marcus was also writing a book that summer of 76. Not so much a book, in Joyce's sense, as a study. It was called Chimeric Mice, an evaluation and practical exploration of the work of Brinster, 1974, concerning the embryonic fusion of mouse strains at the 8-cell stage of development. Joyce had read biology in college, but she didn't attempt to touch the many-paged manuscript that was growing like a molehill at her husband's feet. Joyce knew her limitations. She had no great desire to read Marcus's books. It was enough just to know they were being written, somehow. It was enough to know the man she had married was writing them. Her husband didn't just make money, he didn't just make things or sell things that other people had made, he created beings. He went to the edges of his god's imagination and made mice Yahweh could not conceive of. Mice with rabbit genes, mice with webbed feet, or so Joyce imagined, she didn't ask. Mice who year after year expressed more and more eloquently Marcus's designs, from the hit-or-miss process of selective breeding to the chimeric fusion of embryos. And then the rapid developments that lay beyond Joyce's ken and in Marcus's future. DNA microinjection, retrovirus-mediated transgenesis, for which he came within an inch of the Nobel, 1987. Embryonic stem cell-mediated gene transfer. All processes by which Marcus manipulated ova, regulated the over or underexpression of a gene, planting instructions and imperatives in the germline to be realized in physical characteristics. Creating mice whose very bodies did exactly what Marcus told them. And always with humanity in mind, a cure for cancer, cerebral palsy, Parkinson's, always with the firm belief in the perfectibility of all life, in the possibility of making it more efficient, more logical, for illness was, to Marcus, nothing more than bad logic on the part of the genome, just as capitalism was nothing more than bad logic on the part of the social animal. More effective, more chauvinist in the way it proceeded. He expressed contempt equally towards the animal rights maniacs, horrible people Joyce had to shoo from the door with a curtain pole when a few extremists caught wind of Marcus's dealings in mice, or the hippies, or the tree people, or anyone who failed to grasp the simple fact that social and scientific progress were brothers in arms. It was the Chalfen way, handed down the family for generations. They had a congenital inability to suffer fools gladly or otherwise. If you were arguing with a Chalfen, trying to put a case for these strange Frenchmen who think truth is a function of language, or that history is interpretive and science metaphorical, the Chalfen in question would hear you out quietly, then wave his hand, dismissive, feeling no need to dignify such bunkum with a retort. Truth was truth to a Chalfen, and genius was genius. Marcus created beings, and Joyce was his wife, industrious in creating smaller versions of Marcus. 15 years later, and Joyce would still challenge anyone to show her a happier marriage than hers. 3 more children had followed Joshua. Benjamin, 14, Jack, 12, and Oscar, 6. Bouncy, curly-haired boys, all articulate and amusing. The Inner Life of Houseplants, 1984, and A College Chair for Marcus had seen them through the 80s boom and bust, financing an extra bathroom, a conservatory, and life's pleasures, old cheese, good wine, winters in Florence. Now there were 2 new works in progress, The Secret Passions of the Climbing Rose and Transgenic Mice, a study of the inherent limitations of DNA microinjection, Gordon and Ruddle, 1981, in comparison with embryonic stem, ES, cell-mediated gene transfer, Gosler et al., 1986. Marcus was also working on a pop science book, against his better judgment, a collaboration with a novelist that he hoped would finance at least the first 2 children well into their university years. Joshua was a star maths pupil. Benjamin wanted to be a geneticist, just like his father. Jack's passion was psychiatry, and Oscar could checkmate his father's king in 15 moves. And all this despite the fact that the Chelfins had sent their kids to Glenard Oak, daring to take the ideological gamble their peers guiltily avoided. Those nervous liberals who shrugged their shoulders and coughed up the cash for a private education. And not only were they bright children, they were happy. Not hothoused in any way. Their only after-school activity, they despised sport, was the individual therapy 5 times a week at the hands of an old-fashioned Freudian called Marjorie, who did Joyce and Marcus, separately, on weekends. It might appear extreme to non-Chalfins, but Marcus had been brought up with a strong respect for therapy. In his family, therapy had long supplanted Judaism, and there was no arguing with the result. Every Chalfin proclaimed themselves mentally healthy and emotionally stable. The children had their Oedipal complexes early and in the right order. They were all fiercely heterosexual. They adored their mother and admired their father, and, unusually, this feeling only increased as they reached adolescence. Rows were rare, playful, and only ever over political or intellectual topics. The importance of anarchy, the need for higher taxes, the problem of South Africa, the soul-body dichotomy, upon which they all agreed anyway. The Chalfins had no friends. They interacted mainly with the Chalfin extended family. The good genes, which were so often referred to. 2 scientists, 1 mathematician, 3 psychiatrists, and a young cousin working for the Labour Party. Under sufferance and on public holidays, they visited Joyce's long-rejected lineage, the Connor clan, Daily Mail letter writers who even now could not disguise their distaste for Joyce's Israelite love match. Bottom line, the Chalfins didn't need other people. They referred to themselves as nouns, verbs, and, occasionally, adjectives. It's the Chalfin way. And then he came out with a real Chalfinism. He's Chalfining again. We need to be a bit more Chalfinist about this. Joyce challenged anyone to show her a happier family, a more Chalfinist family than theirs. And yet, Joyce pined for the golden age when she was the linchpin of the Chalfin family, when people couldn't eat without her, when people couldn't dress without her assistance. Now even Oscar could make himself a snack. Sometimes there seemed nothing to improve, nothing to cultivate. Recently she found herself pruning the dead sections from her rambling rose, wishing she could find some fault of Joshua's worthy of attention, some secret trauma of Jack's or Benjamin's, a perversion in Oscar. But they were all perfect. Sometimes, when the Chalfins sat round their Sunday dinner, tearing apart a chicken until there was nothing left but a tattered ribcage, gobbling silently, speaking only to retrieve the salt or the pepper, the boredom was palpable. The century was drawing to a close, and the Chalfins were bored. Like clones of each other, their dinner table was an exercise in mirrored perfection, Chalfinism and all its principles reflecting itself infinitely, bouncing from Oscar to Joyce, Joyce to Joshua, Joshua to Marcus, Marcus to Benjamin, Benjamin to Jack, ad nauseam across the meat and veg. They were still the same remarkable family they always had been, but having cut all ties with their Oxbridge peers, judges, TV execs, advertisers, lawyers, actors, and other frivolous professions Chalfinism sneered at, there was no one left to admire Chalfinism itself. Its gorgeous logic, its compassion, its intellect. They were like wild-eyed passengers of the Mayflower with no rock in sight. Pilgrims and prophets with no strange land. They were bored, and none more than Joyce. To fill long days left alone in the house, Marcus commuted to his college. Joyce's boredom often drove her to flick through the Chalfins' enormous supply of delivered magazines. New Marxism, Living Marxism, New Scientist, Oxfam Report, Third World Action, Anarchist's Journal. And feel a yearning for the bald Romanians or beautiful pot-bellied Ethiopians. Yes, she knew it was awful, but there it was. Children crying out from glossy paper, needing her. She needed to be needed. She'd be the first to admit it. She hated it, for example, when one after the other, her children, pop-eyed addicts of breast milk, finally kicked the habit. She usually stretched it to 2 or 3 years, and, in the case of Joshua, 4, but though the supply never ended, the demand did. She lived in dread of the inevitable moment when they moved from soft drugs to hard, the switch from calcium to the sugared delights of Ribena. It was when she finished breastfeeding Oscar that she threw herself back into gardening, back into the warm mulch where tiny things relied on her. Then one fine day, Milat Iqbal and Irie Jones walked reluctantly into her life. She was in the back garden at the time, tearfully examining her garter night delphiniums, heliotrope and cobalt blue with a jet black center like a bullet hole in the sky, for signs of thrip, a nasty pest that had already butchered her begonia. The doorbell rang. Tilting her head back, Joyce waited till she could hear the slippered feet of Marcus running down the stairs from his study, and then, satisfied that he would answer it, delved back into the thick. With raised eyebrows, she inspected the mouthy double blooms which stood to attention along the delphinium's 8-foot spine. Thrip, she said to herself out loud, acknowledging the dog-eared mutation on every other flower. Thrip, she repeated, not without pleasure, for it would need seeing to now, and might even give rise to a book or at least a chapter. Thrip. Joyce knew a thing or two about thrip. Thrips, common name for minute insects that feed on a wide range of plants, enjoying in particular the warm atmosphere required for an indoor or exotic plant. Most species are no more than 1.5 millimeters, 0.06 inch, long as adults. Some are wingless, but others have two pairs of short wings fringed with hairs. Both adults and nymphs have sucking, piercing mouthparts. Although thrips pollinate some plants and also eat some insect pests, they are both boon and bane for the modern gardener and are generally considered pests to be controlled with insecticides, such as Lindex. Scientific classification, thrips make up the order Thysanoptera. Joyce Chalfin, The Inner Life of Houseplants, from the Index on Pests and Parasites. Yes, thrips have good instincts. Essentially, they are charitable, productive organisms which help the plant in its development. Thrips mean well, but thrips go too far. Thrips go beyond pollinating and eating pests. Thrips begin to eat the plant itself, to eat it from within. Thrip will infect generation after generation of delphiniums if you let it. What can one do about thrip if, as in this case, the Lindex hadn't worked? What can you do but prune hard, prune ruthlessly, and begin from the beginning? Joyce took a deep breath. She was doing this for the delphinium. She was doing this because without her, the delphinium had no chance. Joyce slipped the huge garden scissors out of her apron pocket, grabbed the screaming orange handles firmly, and placed the exposed throat of a blue delphinium bloom between two slices of silver. Tough love.
Joyce! Joyce! Joshua and his marijuana-smoking friends are here!
Pulchritude. From the Latin, pulca. Beautiful. That was the word that first struck Joyce when Milat Iqbal stepped forward onto the steps of her conservatory, sneering at Marcus's bad jokes, shading his violet eyes from a fading winter sun. Pulchritude. Not just the concept, but the whole physical word appeared before her as if someone had typed it onto her retina. Pulchritude. Beauty where you would least suspect it, hidden in a word that looked like it should signify a belch or a skin infection. Beauty in a tall brown young man who should have been indistinguishable to Joyce from those she regularly bought milk and bread from, gave her accounts to for inspection, or passed her checkbook to from behind the thick glass of a bank till.
Milat Iqbal, said Marcus, making a performance of the foreign syllables. And Irie Jones, apparently, friends of Josh's. I was just saying to Josh, these are the best-looking friends of his we've ever seen. They're usually small and weedy, so long-sighted they're short-sighted, and with club feet, and they're never female. Well, continued Marcus jovially, dismissing Joshua's look of horror, it's a damn good thing you turned up. We've been looking for a woman to marry old Joshua.
Marcus was standing on the garden steps, quite openly admiring Irie's breasts, though, to be fair, Irie was a good head and shoulders taller than him.
He's a good sort, smart, a bit weak on fractals, but we love him anyway. Well.
Marcus paused for Joyce to come out of the garden, take off her gloves, shake hands with Milat, and follow them all into the kitchen.
You are a big girl,
Thanks.
We like that around here, a healthy eater. All Chalfins are healthy eaters. I don't put on a pound, but Joyce does, in all the right places, naturally. You're staying for dinner?
Iris stood dumb in the middle of the kitchen, too nervous to speak. These were not any species of parent she recognized.
Oh, don't worry about Marcus, said Joshua with a jolly wink. He's a bit of an old lech. It's a Chalfin joke. They like to bombard you the minute you get in the door, find out how sharp you are. Chalfins don't think there's any point in pleasantries. Joyce, this is Irie and Milat. They're the two from behind the science block.
Joyce, partially recovered from the vision of Milat Iqbal, gathered herself together sufficiently to play her designated role as Mother Chalfin.
So, you're the two who've been corrupting my eldest son. I'm Joyce. Do you want some tea? So you're Josh's bad crowd. I was just pruning the delphiniums. This is Benjamin, Jack, and that's Oscar in the hallway. Strawberry and mango, or normal?
Normal for me, thanks, Joyce, said Joshua.
Same, thanks, said Irie.
Yeah, said Milat.
Three normal and one mango, please, Marcus, darling, please.
Marcus, who was just heading out the door with a newly packed tobacco pipe, backtracked with a weary smile.
I'm a slave to this woman, he said, grabbing her around the waist, like a gambler collecting his chips and circled arms. But if I wasn't, she might run off with any pretty young man who rolled into the house. I don't fancy falling victim to Darwinism this week.
This hug, explicit as a hug can be, was directed frontways on, seemingly for the appreciation of Milat. Joyce's big, milky blue eyes were on him all the time.
That's what you want, Irie, said Joyce in a familial stage whisper, as if they'd known each other for 5 years rather than 5 minutes. A man like Marcus for the long term. These fly-by-nights are all right fun, but what kind of fathers do they make?
Joshua coloured.
Joyce, she just stepped into the house. Let her have some tea.
Joyce feigned surprise.
I haven't embarrassed you, have I? You have to forgive, Mother Chalfin. My foot and mouth are on intimate terms.
But Irie wasn't embarrassed. She was fascinated, enamoured after 5 minutes. No one in the Jones household made jokes about Darwin, or said, my foot and mouth are on intimate terms, or offered choices of tea, or let speech flow freely from adult to child, child to adult, as if the channel of communication between these two tribes was untrammelled, unblocked by history, free.
Well, said Joyce, released by Marcus and planting herself down at the circular table, inviting them to do the same. You look very exotic. Where are you from, if you don't mind me asking?
Wilston, said Irie and Milat simultaneously.
Yes, yes, of course, but where originally?
Oh,
said Milat, putting on what he called a bud-bud-ding-ding accent.
You are meaning where from am I originally?
Joyce looked confused.
Yes, originally.
Whitechapel, said Milat, pulling out a fag, via the Royal London Hospital and the 207 bus.
All the Chalfins milling through the kitchen, Marcus, Josh, Benjamin, Jack, exploded into laughter. Joyce obediently followed suit.
Chill out, man, said Milat, suspicious. It wasn't that fucking funny.
But the Chalfins carried on. Chalfins rarely made jokes unless they were exceptionally lame or numerical in nature, or both. What did the zero say to the eight?
Nice belt. Are you going to smoke that?
Asked Joyce suddenly when the laughter died down, a note of panic in her voice.
In here? Only we hate the smell. We only like the smell of German tobacco. And if we smoke it, we smoke it in Marcus's room because it upsets Oscar otherwise, doesn't it, Oscar?
No,
said Oscar, the youngest and most cherubic of the boys, busy building a Lego empire.
I don't care.
It upsets Oscar,
repeated Joyce in that stage whisper again.
He hates it.
I'll take it to the garden, said Milat slowly, in the kind of voice you use on the insane or foreign. Back in a minute.
As soon as Milat was out of earshot, and as Marcus brought over the teas, the years seemed to fall like dead skin from Joyce, and she bent across the table like a schoolgirl.
God, he's gorgeous, isn't he? Like Omar Sharif 30 years ago. Funny Roman nose. Are you and he...
Leave the girl alone, Joyce, admonished Marcus. She's hardly going to tell you about it, is she?
No, said Irie, feeling she'd like to tell these people everything. We're not.
Just as well. His parents probably have something arranged for him, no? The headmaster told me he was a Muslim boy. I suppose he should be thankful he's not a girl, though. Hmm? Unbelievable what they do to the girls. Remember that Time article, Marcus?
Marcus was foraging in the fridge for a cold plate of yesterday's potatoes.
Unbelievable.
But, you know, just from the little I've seen, he doesn't seem at all like most Muslim children. I mean, I'm talking from personal experience. I go into a lot of schools with my gardening, working with kids of all ages. They're usually so silent, you know, terribly meek, but he's so full of spunk. But boys like that want the tall blondes, don't they? I mean, that's the bottom line when they're that handsome. I know how you feel. I used to like the troublemakers when I was your age, but you learn later. You really do. Danger isn't really sexy. Take my word for it. You'd do a lot better with someone like Joshua. Mum, he's been talking about you non-stop all week. Mum!
Joyce faced her reprimand with a little smile.
Well, maybe I'm being too frank for you young people. I don't know. In my day, you were just a lot more direct. You had to be if you wanted to catch the right man. 200 girls in the university and 2,000 men. They were fighting for a girl. But if you were smart, you were choosy.
My, you were choosy,
said Marcus, shuffling up behind her and kissing her ear. And with such good taste. Joyce took the kisses like a girl indulging her best friend's younger brother.
But your mother wasn't sure, was she? She thought I was too intellectual, that I wouldn't want children.
But you convinced her. Those hips would convince anyone.
Yes, in the end. But she underestimated me, didn't she? She didn't think I was Chalfin material.
She just didn't know you then.
Well, we surprised her, didn't we?
A lot of hard copulation went into pleasing that woman.
4 grandchildren later.
During this exchange, Irie tried to concentrate on Oscar, now creating an Ouroboros from a big pink elephant by stuffing the trunk into its own rear end. She'd never been so close to this strange and beautiful thing, the middle class, and experienced the kind of embarrassment that is actually intrigue, fascination. It was both strange and wondrous. She felt like the prude who walks through a nudist beach, examining the sand. She felt like Columbus meeting the exposed Arawaks, not knowing where to look.
"Excuse my parents," said Joshua. "They can't keep their hands off each other."
But even this was said with pride, because the Chalfin children knew their parents were rare creatures, a happily married couple, numbering no more than a dozen in the whole of Glenard Oak. Irie thought of her own parents, whose touches were now virtual, existing only in the absences where both sets of fingers had previously been, the remote control, the biscuit tin lid, the light switches. She said, "It must be great to feel that way after 20 years, or whatever." Joyce swiveled round as if someone had released a catch.
"It's marvellous. It's incredible. You just wake up one morning and realise monogamy isn't a bind. It sets you free, and children need to grow up around that. I don't know if you've ever experienced it. You read a lot about how Afro-Caribbeans seem to find it hard to establish long-term relationships. That's terribly sad, isn't it? I wrote about one Dominican woman in The Inner Life of Houseplants, who had moved her potted azalea through 6 different men's houses, one by the windowsill, then in a dark corner, then in the south-facing bedroom, etc. You just can't do that to a plant."
This was a classic Joyce tangent, and Marcus and Joshua rolled their eyes affectionately. Millat, fag finished, sloped back in.
"Are we going to get some studying done, yeah? This is all very nice, but I want to go out this evening, at some point."
While Irie had been lost in her reveries assessing the Chalfins like a romantic anthropologist, Millat had been out in the garden looking through the windows casing the joint. Where Irie saw culture, refinement, class, intellect, Millat saw money, lazy money, money that was just hanging around this family not doing anything in particular, money in need of a good cause that might as well be him.
"So," said Joyce, clapping her hands, trying to keep them all in the room a little longer, trying to hold off, for as long as possible, the reassertion of Chalfin silence. "You're all going to be studying together."
Well, you and Irie are really welcome. I was saying to your headmaster, wasn't I, Marcus, that this really shouldn't feel like punishment. It's not exactly a heinous crime. Between us, I used to be a pretty good marijuana gardener myself at one time. Way out, said Millat. Nurture, thought Joyce. Be patient, water regularly, and don't lose your temper when pruning. And your headmaster explained to us how your home environments aren't exactly... Well, I'm sure you'll find it easier to work here. Such an important year, the GCSEs. And it's so obvious that you're both bright. Anyone can tell that just by looking at your eyes, can't they, Marcus?
Josh, your mother's asking me whether IQ expresses itself in the secondary physical characteristics of eye colour, eye shape, etc. Is there a sensible answer to this inquiry?
Joyce pressed on. Mice and men, genes and germs. That was Marcus's corner. Seedlings, light sources, growth, nurture, the buried heart of things, that was hers. As on any missionary vessel, tasks were delegated. Marcus on the prow, looking for the storm. Joyce beneath deck, checking the linen for bedbugs. Your headmaster knows how much I hate to see potential wasted. That's why he sent you to us.
And because he knows most of the Chalfins are 400 times smarter than him, said Jack, doing a star jump.
He was still young and hadn't yet learnt to demonstrate his pride in his family in a more socially acceptable manner.
Even Oscar is.
No, I'm not,
said Oscar, kicking in a Lego garage he had recently made.
I'm the stupidest in the world.
Oscar's got an IQ of 178,
whispered Joyce.
It's a bit daunting, even when you're his mum.
Wow, said Irie, turning with the rest of the room, to appreciate Oscar trying to ingest the head of a plastic giraffe.
That's remarkable. Yes, but he's had everything, and so much of it is nurture, isn't it? I really believe that. We've just been lucky enough to give him so much, and with a daddy like Marcus, it's like having a strong sunbeam shining on him 24 hours a day, isn't it, darling? He's so fortunate to have that. Well, they all are. Now, you may think this sounds strange, but it was always my aim to marry a man cleverer than me.
Joyce put her hands on her hips and waited for Irie to think that sounded strange.
No, I really did, and I'm a staunch feminist, Marcus will tell you.
She's a staunch feminist, said Marcus from the inner sanctum of the fridge.
I don't suppose you can understand that. Your generation have different ideas, but I knew it would be liberating, and I knew what kind of father I wanted for my children.
Now, that surprised you, hasn't it? I'm sorry, but we really don't do small talk around here.
If you're going to be here every week, I thought it best you got a proper dose of the Chalfins now.
All the Chalfins who were in earshot for this last comment smiled and nodded. Joyce paused and looked at Irie and Millat the way she had looked at her garter knight delphinium. She was a quick and experienced detector of illness, and there was damage here. There was a quiet pain in the first one. Irianthus nigrescium marcosilia. A lack of a father figure, perhaps, an intellect untapped, a low self-esteem. And in the second, melateria brandolidia Joyce Calatus. There was a deeper sadness, a terrible loss, a gaping wound. A hole that needed more than education or money. That needed love. Joyce longed to touch the site with the tip of her Chalfin green finger, close the gap, knit the skin.
Can I ask, your father, what is he?
Joyce wondered what the parents did, what they had done. When she found a mutated first bloom, she wanted to know where the cutting had come from. Wrong question. It wasn't the parents. It wasn't just one generation. It was the whole century. Not the bud, but the bush.
Curry shifter, said Millat. Busboy, waiter.
Paper, began Irie. Kind of folding it and working on things like perforations. Kind of direct mail advertising, but not really advertising, at least not the ideas end. Kind of folding, she gave up. It's hard to explain.
Yes. When there's a lack of a male role model, you see, that's when things really go awry, in my experience. I wrote an article for Women's Earth
Recently, I described a school I worked in where I gave all the children a potted, busy Lizzie and told them to look after it for a week like a daddy or mummy looks after a baby. Each child chose which parent they were going to emulate. This lovely little Jamaican boy, Winston, chose his daddy. The next week, his mother phoned and asked why I'd asked Winston to feed his plant Pepsi and put it in front of the television. I mean, it's just terrible, isn't it? But I think a lot of these parents just don't appreciate their children sufficiently. Partly it's the culture, you know? It just makes me so angry. The only thing I allow Oscar to watch is News Round for half an hour a day. That's more than enough.
Lucky Oscar, said Millard.
Anyway, I'm just really excited about you being here because the Chalfins, I mean, it may sound peculiar, but I really wanted to persuade your headmaster this was the best idea. And now I've met you both, I'm even more certain because the Chalfins know how to bring the right things out in people, finished Joshua. They did with me.
Yes, said Joyce, relieved her search for words was over, radiating pride. Yes.
Joshua pushed his chair back from the table and stood up. Well, we'd better get down to some study.
Marcus, could you come up and help us a bit later on the biology? I'm really bad at reducing the reproductive stuff in bite-sized chunks.
Sure. I'm working on my future mouse, though.
This was the family joke name for Marcus's project, and the younger Chalfin sang Future Mouse after him, imagining an anthropomorphic rodent in red shorts.
And I've got to play a bit of piano with Jack first. Scott Joplin. Jack's the left hand, I'm the right. Not quite Art Tatum, he said, ruffling Jack's hair. But we get by.
Irie tried her hardest to imagine Mr. Iqbal playing the right hand of Scott Joplin with his dead grey digits, or Mr. Jones turning anything into bite-sized chunks. She felt her cheeks flush with the warm heat of Chalfinist revelation. So there existed fathers who dealt in the present, who didn't drag ancient history around like a chain and ball. So there were men who were not neck high and sinking in the quagmire of the past.
You'll stay for dinner, won't you?
Pleaded Joyce.
Oscar really wants you to stay. Oscar loves having strangers in the house. He finds it really stimulating, especially brown strangers. Don't you, Oscar?
No, I don't, confided Oscar, spitting in Irie's ear.
I hate brown strangers.
He finds brown strangers really stimulating, whispered Joyce. This has been the century of strangers, brown, yellow, and white. This has been the century of the great immigrant experiment. It is only this late in the day that you can walk into a playground and find Isaac Lung by the fish pond, Danny Rahman in the football cage, Quang O'Rourke bouncing a basketball, and Irie Jones humming a tune. Children with first and last names on a direct collision course. Names that secrete within them mass exodus, cramped boats and planes, cold arrivals, medical checks. It is only this late in the day, and possibly only in Willesden, that you can find best friends, Sita and Sharon, constantly mistaken for each other because Sita is white, her mother liked the name, and Sharon is Pakistani, her mother thought it best, less trouble. Yet, despite all the mixing up, despite the fact that we have finally slipped into each other's lives with reasonable comfort, like a man returning to his lover's bed after a midnight walk, despite all this, it is still hard to admit that there is no one more English than the Indian, no one more Indian than the English. There are still young white men who are angry about that, who will roll out at closing time into the poorly lit streets with a kitchen knife wrapped in a tight fist. But it makes an immigrant laugh to hear the fears of the nationalist, scared of infection, penetration, miscegenation, when this is small fry, peanuts, compared to what the immigrant fears, dissolution, disappearance. Even the unflappable Alsana Iqbal would regularly wake up in a puddle of her own sweat after a night visited by visions of Millat, genetically uppercase BB, where uppercase B stands for Bengaliness, marrying someone called Sarah, lowercase AA, where a lowercase a stands for Aryan, resulting in a child called Michael, uppercase B, lowercase a, who in turn marries somebody called Lucy,
lowercase double a, leaving Alsana with a legacy of unrecognizable great-grandchildren, uppercase a, exclamation mark. Their Bengaliness thoroughly diluted, genotype hidden by phenotype. It is both the most irrational and natural feeling in the world. In Jamaica, it is even in the grammar. There is no choice of personal pronoun, no splits between me or you or they. There is only the pure, homogeneous I. When Hortense Bowden, half-white herself, got to hearing about Clara's marriage, she came round to the house, stood on the doorstep, said,
"Understand? I and I don't speak from this moment forth."
Turned on her heel and was true to her word. Hortense hadn't put all that effort into marrying black, into dragging her genes back from the brink, just so her daughter could bring yet more high-colored children into the world. Likewise, in the Iqbal house, the lines of battle were clearly drawn. When Milat brought an Emily or a Lucy back home, Alsana quietly wept in the kitchen. Samad went into the garden to attack the coriander. The next morning was a waiting game, a furious biting of tongues until the Emily or Lucy left the house and the war of words could begin. But with Irie and Clara, the issue was mostly unspoken, for Clara knew she was not in a position to preach. Still, she made no attempt to disguise her disappointment or the aching sadness. From Irie's bedroom shrine of green-eyed Hollywood idols to the gaggle of white friends who regularly trooped in and out of her bedroom, Clara saw an ocean of pink skin surrounding her daughter, and she feared the tides that would take her away. It was partly for this reason that Irie didn't mention the Chalfins to her parents. It wasn't that she intended to mate with the Chalfins, but the instinct was the same. She had a nebulous 15-year-old's passion for them, overwhelming yet with no real direction or object. She just wanted to, well, kind of merge with them. She wanted their Englishness, their Chalfishness, the purity of it. It didn't occur to her that the Chalfins were, after a fashion, immigrants too, third generation by the way of Germany and Poland, nay Chalfinovsky, or that they might be as needy of her as she was of them. To Irie, the Chalfins were more English than the English. When Irie stepped over the threshold of the Chalfin house, she felt an illicit thrill, like a Jew munching a sausage or a Hindu grabbing a Big Mac. She was crossing borders, sneaking into England. It felt like some terribly mutinous act, wearing somebody else's uniform or somebody else's skin. She just said she had netball on Tuesday evenings and left it at that. Conversation flowed at the Chalfin house. It seemed to Irie that here nobody prayed or hid their feelings in a toolbox or silently stroked fading photographs, wondering what might have been. Conversation was the stuff of life.
"Hello, Irie. Come in, come in. Josh was in the kitchen with Joyce. You're looking well. Milat not with you?"
"Coming later. He's got a date."
"Ah, yes. Well, if there are any questions on your exams on oral communication, he'll fly through them. Joyce! Irie's here. So, how's the study going? It's been, what, 4 months now? The Chalfin genius rubbing off?"
"Yeah, not bad, not bad. I never thought I had a scientific bone in my body, but it seems to be working. I don't know, though, sometimes my brain hurts."
"That's just the right side of your brain waking up after a long sleep, getting back into the swing of things. I'm really impressed. I told you it was possible to turn a wishy-washy art student into a science student in no time at all. Oh, and I've got the future mouse pictures. Remind me later. You wanted to see them, no? Joyce, the big brown goddess has arrived."
"Marcus, chill out, man." "Hi, Joyce. Hi, Josh. Hey, Jack. Ooh, hello, Oscar, you cutie."
"Hello, Irie. Come here and give me a kiss. Oscar, look, it's Irie come to see us again. Oh, look at his face. He's wondering where Milat is, aren't you, Oscar?"
"No, I'm not."
"Oh, dear. Yes, he is. Look at his little face. He gets very upset when Milat doesn't turn up. Tell Irie the name of the new monkey, Oscar, the one Daddy gave you."
"George."
"No, not George. You called it Milat the monkey. Remember? Because monkeys are mischievous and Milat's just as bad, isn't he, Oscar?"
"Don't know. Don't care."
"Oscar gets terribly upset when Milat doesn't come. He'll be along in a while. He's on a date.
When isn't he on a date? All those busty girls. We might get jealous, mightn't we, Oscar? He spends more time with them than us. But we shouldn't joke. I suppose it's a bit difficult for you.
No, I don't mind, Joyce, really. I'm used to it.
But everybody loves Milat, don't they?
Oscar, it's so hard not to, isn't it? Oscar, we love him, don't we, Oscar?
I hate him.
Oh, Oscar, don't say silly things. Can we all stop talking about Milat, please?
Yes, Joshua, all right.
Did you hear how he gets jealous? I try to explain to him that Milat needs a little extra care. You know, he's from a very difficult background. It's just like when I give more time to my peonies than my Michaelmas daisies. Daisies will grow anywhere. You know, you can be very selfish sometimes, Joshy.
Okay, Mum, okay.
What's happening with dinner? Before study or after? Before, I think, Joyce. No? I've got to work on Future Mouse all night.
Future Mouse?
Shh, Oscar, I'm trying to listen to Daddy. Because I'm delivering a paper tomorrow, so best have dinner early, if that's all right with you, Irie. I know how you like your food.
That's fine.
Don't say things like that, Marcus. Dear, she's very touchy about her weight.
No, I'm really not.
Touchy? About her weight? But everybody likes a big girl, don't they? I know I do. Evening all. Door's ajar. Let myself in. One day somebody's gonna wander in here and murder the fucking lot of you.
Milat! Oscar, look, it's Milat. Oscar, you're very happy to see Milat, aren't you, darling?
Oscar screwed up his nose, pretended to bath, and threw a wooden hammer at Milat's shins.
Oscar gets so excited when he sees you. Well, you're just in time for dinner. Chicken with cauliflower cheese. Sit down. Josh, put Milat's coat somewhere. So, how are things?
Milat sat down at the table with violence and eyes that looked like they had recently seen tears. He pulled out his pouch of tobacco and a little bag of weed.
Fucking awful. Awful how?
Inquired Marcus with little attention, otherwise engaged in cutting himself a chunk from an enormous block of Stilton.
Girl wouldn't get in your pants? Girl not wearing pants? Out of interest, what kind of pants was she? Dad, give it a rest, moaned Joshua. Well, if you ever actually got into anybody's pants, Josh, said Marcus, looking pointedly at Irie, I'd be able to get my kicks through you. But so far...
Shh! The two of you! Snapped Joyce. I'm trying to listen to Milat.
4 months ago, having a cool mate like Milat had seemed to Josh one hell of a lucky break. Having him round his house every Tuesday had upped Josh's ante at Glenard Oak by more than he could have imagined. And now that Milat, encouraged by Irie, had begun to come of his own accord, to come socially, Joshua Chalfin, nay Chalfin the Chubster, should have felt his star rising. But he didn't. He felt pissed off. For Joshua had not bargained on the power of Milat's attractiveness, his magnet-like qualities. He saw that Irie was still, deep down, stuck on him like a paperclip, and even his own mother seemed sometimes to take Milat as her only focus, all her energy for her gardening, her children, her husband, streamlined and drawn to this one object like so many iron filings. It pissed him off.
I can't talk now. I can't talk in my own house.
Joshy, don't be silly. Milat's obviously upset. I'm just trying to deal with that at the moment.
Poor little Joshy, said Milat in slow, malicious, purring tones. Not getting enough attention from his mummy. Want mummy to wipe his bottom for him? Fuck you, Milat, said Joshua.
Ooh!
Joyce, Marcus, appealed Joshua,
looking for an external judgment.
Tell him!
Marcus popped a great wedge of cheese in his mouth and shrugged his shoulders.
I'm afraid Milat's oil marries jurisdiction.
Let me just deal with this first, Joshy, began Joyce, and then later.
Joyce allowed the rest of her sentence to get jammed in the kitchen door just as her eldest son slammed it.
Shall I go after?
Asked Benjamin. Joyce shook her head and kissed Benjamin on the cheek.
No, Benji, best leave him to it.
She turned back to Milat, touching his face, tracing the salt path of an old tear with her finger.
Now, what's been going on?
Milat began slowly rolling his spliff. He liked to make them wait. You could get more out of a chalfin if you made them wait.
Oh, Milat, don't
don't smoke that stuff. Every time we see you these days, you're smoking. It upsets Oscar so much. He's not that young, and he understands more than you think. He understands about marijuana.
What's marijuana?
Asked Oscar.
You know what it is, Oscar. It's what makes Milat all horrible, like we were talking about today, and it's what kills the little brain cells he has. Get off my fucking back, Joyce. I'm just trying to...
Joyce sighed with melodrama and drew her fingers through her hair.
Milat, what's the matter? Do you need some money?
Yeah, I do, as it happens.
Why? What happened? Milat, talk to me. Family again.
Milat tucked the orange cardboard roach in and stuck the joint between his lips.
Dad chucked me out, didn't he?
Oh, God,
said Joyce, tears springing immediately, pulling her chair closer and taking his hand.
If I was your mother, I'm not, am I? But she's just so incompetent. It makes me so... I mean, imagine letting your husband take away one of your children and do God knows what with the other one. I just...
Don't talk about my mother. You've never met her. I wasn't even talking about her.
Well, she refuses to meet me,
doesn't she? As if it was some kind of competition.
Shut the fuck up, Joyce.
Well, there's no point, is there? Going into... It upsets you to...
I can see that, clearly. It's all too close to the... Marcus, get some tea. He needs tea.
For fuck's sake, I don't want any fucking tea. All you ever do is drink tea. You lot must piss pure bloody tea.
Milat, I'm just trying... Well, don't.
A little hash seed fell out of Milat's joint and stuck on his lips. He picked it off and popped it in his mouth.
I could do with some brandy, though, if there is any.
Joyce motioned to Irie with a what-can-you-do look and mimed a tiny measure of her 30-year-old Napoleon brandy between forefinger and thumb. Irie stood on an overturned bucket to get it off the top shelf.
Okay, let's all calm down. Okay? Okay. So, what happened this time?
I called him a cunt.
He is a cunt.
Milat walloped Oscar's creeping fingers that were looking for a plaything and reaching speculatively for his matches.
I'll need somewhere to stay for a bit.
Well, that's not even a question. You can stay at ours, naturally.
Irie reached between the two of them, Joyce and Milat, to place the big-bottomed brandy glass on the table.
Okay, Irie, give him a little space right now, I think.
I was just...
Yes, okay, Irie. He just doesn't need crowding right at this moment.
He's a bloody hypocrite, man.
Milat cut in with a growl, looking into the middle distance and speaking to the conservatory as much as to anyone.
He prays 5 times a day, but he still drinks and he doesn't have any Muslim friends. Then he has a go at me for fucking a white girl. And then he's pissed off about Majid. He takes all his shit out on me. And he wants me to stop hanging around with Kevin. I'm more of a fucking Muslim than he is. Fuck him!
Do you want to talk about it with all of this lot about?
Said Joyce, looking meaningfully round the room.
Or just us?
Joyce, said Milat, downing his brandy in one. I don't give a fuck.
Joyce took that to mean just us and ushered the rest of them out of the room with her eyes. Irie was glad to leave. In the 4 months that she and Milat had been turning up to the Chalfins, ploughing through Double Science, Band I, and eating their selection of boiled food, a strange pattern had developed. The more progress Irie made, whether in her studies, her attempts to make polite conversation, or her studied imitation of Chalfinism, the less interest Joyce showed in her. Yet the more Milat veered off the rails, turning up uninvited on a Sunday night, off his face, bringing round girls, smoking weed all over the house, drinking their 1964 Dom Perignon on the sly, pissing on the rose garden, holding a Kevin meeting in the front room, running up a £300 phone bill calling Bangladesh, telling Marcus he was a queer, threatening to castrate Joshua, calling Oscar a spoilt little shit, accusing Joyce herself of being a maniac, the more Joyce adored him. In 4 months, he already owed her over £300, a new duvet and a bike wheel.
"Are you coming upstairs?" asked Marcus
as he closed the kitchen door on the two of them and bent this way and that like a reed while his children blew past him.
"I've got those pictures you wanted to see."
Irie gave Marcus a thankful smile. It was Marcus who seemed to keep an eye out for her. It was Marcus who had helped her these 4 months as her brain changed from something mushy to something hard and defined. As she slowly gained a familiarity with the Chalfin way of thinking. She had thought of this as a great sacrifice on the part of a busy man, but more recently she wondered if there was not some enjoyment in it, like watching a blind man feeling out the contours of a new object, maybe, or a laboratory rat making sense of a maze. Either way, in exchange for his attention, Eyrie had begun to take an interest, first strategic and now genuine, in his future mouse. Consequently, invitations to Marcus's study at the very top of the house, by far her favourite room, had become more frequent.
"Well, don't stand there grinning like the village idiot. Come on up."
Marcus's room was like no place Eyrie had ever seen. It had no communal utility, no other purpose in the house, apart from being Marcus's room. It stored no toys, bric-a-brac, broken things, spare ironing boards. No one ate in it, slept in it, or made love in it. It wasn't like Clara's attic space, a Xanadu of crap, all carefully stored in boxes and labelled, just in case she should ever need to flee this land for another one. It wasn't like the spare rooms of immigrants, packed to the rafters with all that they have ever possessed, no matter how defective or damaged, mountains of odds and ends, that stand testament to the fact that they have things now, where before they had nothing. Marcus's room was purely devoted to Marcus and Marcus's work. A study, like in Austin, or Upstairs Downstairs, or Sherlock Holmes, except this was the first study Eyrie had ever seen in real life. The room itself was small and irregular with a sloping floor, wooden eaves that meant it was possible to stand in certain places, but not others, and a skylight rather than a window, which let light through in slices, spotlights for dancing dust. There were 4 filing cabinets, open-mouthed beasts spitting paper, paper in piles on the floor, on the shelves, in circles around the chairs. The smell of a rich, sweet Germanic tobacco sat in a cloud just above head level, staining the leaves of the highest books yellow, and there was an elaborate smoking set on a side table, spare mouthpieces, pipes ranging from the standard U-bend to ever more curious shapes, snuff boxes, a selection of gauzes, all laid out in a velvet-lined leather case like a doctor's instruments. Scattered about the walls and lining the fireplace were photos of the Chalfin clan, including comely portraits of Joyce in her pert-breasted hippie youth, a retroussé nose sneaking out between 2 great sheaths of hair. And then a few larger framed centrepieces, a map of the Chalfin family tree, a headshot of Mendel looking pleased with himself, a big poster of Einstein in his American icon stage, nutty professor hair, surprised look, and huge pipe, subtitled with the quote, "God does not play dice with the world." Finally, Marcus's large oaken armchair backed onto a portrait of Crick and Watson looking tired but elated in front of their model of deoxyribonucleic acid, a spiral staircase of metal clamps reaching from the floor of their Cambridge lab to beyond the scope of the photographer's lens.
"But where's Wilkins?" inquired Marcus, bending where the ceiling got low and tapping the photo with a pencil. 1962. Wilkins won the Nobel in medicine with Crick and Watson. But no sign of Wilkins in the photos. Just Crick and Watson. Watson and Crick. History likes lone geniuses or double acts, but it's got no time for threesomes."
Marcus thought again.
"Unless they're comedians or jazz musicians."
"Suppose you'll have to be a lone genius, then,"
said Eyrie cheerfully, turning from the picture and sitting down on a Swedish backless chair.
"Ah, but I have a mentor, you see."
He pointed to a poster-sized black-and-white photograph on the other wall.
"And mentors are a whole other kettle of fish."
It was an extreme close-up of an extremely old man, the contours of his face clearly defined by line and shade, hashes on a topographic map.
"Grand old Frenchman, a gentleman and a scholar. Taught me practically everything I know. 70-odd and sharp as a whip. But you see, with a mentor, you needn't credit them directly. That's the great thing about them. Now where's this bloody photo?"
While Marcus scrabbled about in a filing cabinet, Eyrie studied a small slice of the Chalfin family tree,
An elaborate illustrated oak that stretched back into the 1600s and forward into the present day. The differences between the Chalfins and the Jones-Bodens were immediately plain. For starters, in the Chalfin family, everybody seemed to have a normal number of children. More to the point, everybody knew whose children were whose. The men lived longer than the women, the marriages were singular and long-lasting, dates of birth and death were concrete, and the Chalfins actually knew who they were in 1675.